visits by pedestrians injured because they tripped or bumped into something while texting or talking on their cell phones. Among the new devices aimed at addressing that problem is a Bluetooth voice-to-text earpiece called Jawbone.
What do you want to jot?
Myself.
Jot yourself.
Type up the meeting minutes and send them to Sean.
Other applications use the camera on a smartphone to beam an image of what's in front of a user so they can see what's coming even while they keep typing or texting. But Stanford University professor Clifford Nass tells the Associated Press that seeing ahead is only part of the solution because, in his words, we're stuck with brains that can't do all that much when we're doing other things. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count special report addresses the importance of reading by the end of third grade at aecf.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives. So as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. And in this first hour of the show today, we will talk with Peter Carey about his new novel, Parrot and Olivier in America. To talk just a little bit about these two characters of the title. Olivier is a French aristocrat, very clearly modeled on Alexis de Tocqueville, a real French aristocrat who came to America in the 1830s and wrote a very famous book. In the book, Olivier is sent to Jacksonian America to conduct a survey of our prison systems, as de Tocqueville did. He's sent here in the company of another man, an Englishman named John Larrett, who is nicknamed Parrot because of his red hair. He goes along as ostensibly as Olivier's servant, but really as his minder. These are two men that are drawn from very different social classes. And in the course of the story, the two of them try to come to grips with all that is good and bad in America. One of them comes away disappointed, but the other ends up finding a new home. The book is just out. It is published by Alfred Knopf, and I'm sure that you would enjoy it if you take a look at it. Our guest, Peter Carey, is the author of 10 previous novels. He has twice received the Booker Prize, and he's one of only two people to have won the Booker twice. His other honors include the Commonwealth Writers Prize, the Miles Franklin Literary Award. He was born in Australia and now lives in New York City and has for 20 years. His other books, they're all available in paperback by Vintage, so if you'd like to read some of his work, you can do that. And as we talk this morning, questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guest here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And you may also send your emails to will-talk. That's just like it sounds, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But listeners are welcome to call. Mr. Carey, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
We appreciate it. To start out here, perhaps we should just tell people a little bit more. I should ask you to tell people a little bit more about these two characters. Beginning with Olivier de Gaumont. Tell us about him.
Well, I suppose the first thing, and this I drew, I guess, from Tocqueville, but I thought it was an insight of a sort. I suddenly realized that this young boy born, I think, in about 1805, into a household where his aristocratic parents have suffered terribly in the French Revolution, in the Reign of Terror, and that the father's has been arrested, his hair's turned white overnight. The mother's also been arrested. They are on the brink of being guillotined. They're young. And just then, Robespierre, the great engine of the terror, is taken off himself to be beheaded. And the parents survive. But all around them, their friends, relations, her father, have lost their lives. And so I started to think of this little boy growing up in this very large chateau, which contains a terror. And the terror is that he doesn't even know what it is. And so I started to think of him as the child of survivors. Mm. And it made a lot of sense about the historical figure of Tocqueville, but it really gave me a sort of a way into a rather strange, clever, courageous little boy, who will also be, of course, a terrible snob. And people think that this is something that the famous Tocqueville wasn't, but he was an aristocrat of his time. And coming to this country, all of them were just appalling. these Americans sort of eating ham constantly and no wine with their meals. And So I sort of started to like inhabiting this voice of this brave, damaged man who's sort of running away from France on the pretext of studying prisons, but who does know that democracy is the wave of the future, that you cannot go backwards. And how is he an aristocrat to survive in this new world, and how is he going to triumph in it and contribute to it without democracy smashing him?
Yeah. And there was a lot of political turbulence and upheaval that followed the revolution, the French Revolution, that he is getting caught up in. He seems in some ways to be someone who, on one hand, is principled, and yet on the other hand is rather naive. And what happens in the course of the story, or early on, is that his parents, because they're worried about him, that he's going to get in trouble, really contrive to get him out of town, to have him sent off on this mission to study American prisons. And their concern there is that he might find himself in jail or worse if he continues on his present course. So they think, well, maybe the best thing to do would be to get him out of France, send him to America, and get him out of harm's way at least for a while.
Yeah, and do it in a way that doesn't look like running away. Mm. Does it in a way that looks like it's something, doing something positive for France. Although, in fact, the French government does not give a damn about what he's doing, and the parents have to pay for all the expenses, but that they will let him do this and keep face.
And he's a character, I think, that he's difficult to like. Although, interestingly enough, as I read, people, apparently different readers in different countries, react rather differently to the two characters, and that there are actually some people who rather like Olivier.
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it? The person who most amused me was, to be personal about it, was my English agent. And she's of a rather sort of grand background. And so her first response was, "Oh, poor Olivier." So her heart was totally with him. As the writer, I couldn't write without feeling affection, really, for both of them, and acting as an advocate for both of them. But Olivier, the thing about it, yeah, Olivier is splenetic, and he is snobbish, and he is irritable. From the writing point of view, you get a certain sort of energy from that. Mm. But it's Parrot, of course, who's... I mean, the challenge for me to write Olivier is how am I, an Australian by birth, having grown up in a working-class town of 5,000 people, going to start to imagine a French aristocrat living in a chateau? I mean, it was... So I had a lot of fun overcoming my nervousness and getting there, but Parrot is one who, I guess, who is closer to my heart.
Yeah. I would expect that, and I would expect that probably for a lot of American readers, that he would be the character that they would find more appealing, that perhaps they could find more to identify with, both in terms of being your archetypal up-from-nothing kind of guy, but maybe also to the way that he responded to America and its possibilities.
Yes, I think so, too. Parrot didn't really want to be there either, but Parrot has traveled so much and really, really, really doesn't want to move anymore and only really finally wants rest and a place to be and a place to live decently. And that turns out that it will be this. But one of the things I was going to say about in constructing these two characters and thinking about them, you know, we will give our hearts more readily, I think, to Parrot. But it might be shocking to see that actually Olivier might have, in the end, a good argument, which is something I've often enjoyed, you know, doing in writing, where, you know, the good guys and the nice guys are not always completely the smartest guys. Sometimes the people we don't like so much have something to contribute. And I think that, you know, Olivier's concerns about democracy, which Parrot thinks are ridiculous, or would, let's say, a market-driven democracy, you know, have, I think... he has some good points to make.
Well, I think that that's one of the maybe one of the pleasing things about the book, and that is, as much as these are both difficult men, and they both have features that make them difficult to like, and this is indeed set in another time, that at the end what you have is an argument between the two of them, Olivier, and there's a, in just a couple of paragraphs or a few lines, sets down and wonderfully, concisely, everything that we still think is wrong with America.
Yeah.
And then, in a way, to balance that, then Parrot says, well, now, wait a minute. It's not that bad. It won't turn out to be as bad as you think. And I think so. It both represents what we really dislike about America, what we think is problematic about it, on the one hand, and then on the other, our hope that, in fact, we can somehow transcend that, and maybe it won't turn out to be as bad as we fear.
Yes, and I within, I think, the whole texture of the book, well, I would hope, one is reminded of, well, maybe the American-born always know this, and it's people like me who discover and rediscover it, the people who come here, and that is, it's easy to forget in the present, in America's present sort of imperial stage of being, what an intensely radical experiment it was. How really wildly radical in a time when the world is run by kings and queens and God gives power to the kings. Suddenly, here's this democracy run by the people, and the potential of it, the immensity of it is... easy to forget, and it was such a short time ago that anything was possible, that I think it does make you think that anything can be possible again. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Peter Carey. His new novel is Parrot and Olivier in America. It is his 11th. It is now out in hardcover, published by Knopf. All of his others are available in vintage paper. This is the book that is this story of these two men, the French aristocrat and this man who he thinks is his servant but actually is really being sent along just to keep an eye on him, and about how they encounter America in the time of Andrew Jackson. It's a good read. You might want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, I read a review of the book, Parrot and Olivier, that was published in an Australian paper. Mm-hmm. And this reviewer made reference to an interview that you did a couple of years ago, where the interviewer essentially said to you something like, well, you know, you've been living in America for 20 years now. Why are you still writing about Australia?
Yep.
And you apparently said something like, well, you know, I lived in Australia for 40 years before I came here. But then you said that apparently one of the things that you really liked about New York, where you live now, was that it's full of people who carried two places in their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the place where they were born and the place where they had chosen to live.
Mm.
And I thought that was a lovely sort of sentiment. And it made me wonder how that entered into this book, and it is, after all, the first book that you've written that actually is set in America.
Yeah, the New York has been in a couple of, but, you know, really as an arrival point for a moment or a departure at the beginning. And certainly this is the first book where I've tried to grapple with, you know, my modern experience of living here and wishing, always wanting to make some contribution to a discussion or to make art which was to do with it, and often thinking that I would not be able to. I mean, it's very, you know, when you have friends, say Richard Price is a friend of mine, and Richard's born here in New York, and he's so deep in it that I would be a fool to attempt to take on that sort of territory. So I've got to find a way within which I can do that. And reading Tocqueville opened a door for me, and I thought I could deal with all of the things that I loved and all of the things that I was frightened of in a way that was perhaps a little daunting, which I like. I mean, Tocqueville's so, you know, beloved and quoted, and one of the most interesting things I discovered, which I was so slow to figure out about Tocqueville, is that so famous, everyone studied him in college and at school, and I slowly realized that basically they'd read the book, most people, my friends, some of them, of course, had read Democracy in America very carefully and so on, but the great majority of them had done it in school where they don't read the whole book. They'd studied the good bits. So what they were seem to be sort of unaware of is the complicated relationship Tocqueville had with America. You know, there were things that he really admired, and there were things that he was very critical of. And the critical things, they seem not to know about.
Well, I think that's really interesting that he's another one of these people that individuals that we know of that probably people can give you two lines. You know, the shorthand is he came here, 1830s, came away admirer of America and admiring democracy, full stop. Well, yeah. The fact of the matter is that he had a lot of reservations about American culture and American life. And I must claim, you know, I know it also only from reading, selected excerpts. But barely if you read everything he wrote, you see that actually there were a lot of things that he had some problems with.
Well, he was seriously worried. I mean, the rule of the majority as a principle was something that was terribly worrying to him. And, of course, you can look at that in a personal psychological level, and you could say, well, anybody who's lost their family to the revolution is going to have a deep fear of the mob. And the notion, and coming with to a country where the ordinary people rule is a terrifying thought. I always thought that if I'd been arguing with him then, I would have said to him, "Don't worry. What you see as the mob will be an electorate, and an electorate through democracy will be educated and literate. And so all of the fears that you have are not well grounded. But as time's gone on, of course, we've rather neglected to educate our people. So we have fellow people may be technically literate. They often aren't. They're certainly not well informed. We have let news become entertainment. And we've finally sort of produced, I think, the very thing he was worried about. And so for citizens to be citizens, they have to be informed. And we have decided not to inform them. And so we have some of the things operating at the moment where you get, you know, strong political forces acting out of hate and ignorance. This is frightening. But you can look and read Democracy in America, and you look in there between the lines, you'll find Sarah Palin. And that was, to me, that was at once sort of terrifying, but also really, really exciting. Because whenever you see when I see the present tucked away in the past, I always think I'm onto something.
Yeah. You clearly had to invent and develop the character Olivier, although you had some help. Because the little bits of the real life of Tocqueville and things that he said helped you, you know, some of his observations you have taken and given them to Olivier. But let's talk about Parrot and and where that character comes from?
Well, you know, I often begin, I mean, by the time I've finished a novel and it's at this stage, the thing I'm really, well, one of the things I'm most proud of is the creation of characters, and that there are people I never knew, who I now know very well, who are walking around in other people's minds and having a life. But at the very, very beginning, I sort of have an idea. And so, you know, the basic idea is an argument about democracy, and there's the aristocrat on the way, and the more working class, or whatever we're going to call somebody who's the son of an itinerant printer. And so they sort of exist in theory, in a way. And I have the notion that the argument will continue and will not actually be resolved, and that I'll give a good argument to somebody we will not expect to have a good argument, and so on. So then the first person I had to deal with, which was the most frightening one for me, was Olivier. And so I wrote the introduction, and I thought, oh, I can do this. I can write this French aristocrat. And then I turned my attention to the person who would be, you know, end up being his servant, and somebody who would want to be an artist at a time when he shouldn't be, and so on. So I don't really... He's sort of born a little bit of a time, you know. It's, his sort of character. That I suppose there's something in it that just sort of comes out of me. I'm not trying to be mumbo jumbo or channeling anything, but he was sort of the voice. The first time you find him in the book is the voice in the way that I first found him, and he, you know, I wanted him to be the son of a printer because I wanted him alone. Having a lowly position in society, to be amongst people who read and argued about politics. So that's one thing. I wanted him to be involved in a printing that was illegal, and so I started to build the thing day by day by day. You know, I put them in a house which had been from an earlier period of time in England when they used to hide. When the Catholic Church was outlawed, rich people built houses with priest holes and places where they could hide the priests, and so they wouldn't be killed. And so it's one of these places I invent and turn into this sort of secret printing works with printers hidden in these hiding places. So all of this happens just a little bit at a time, and. He's sort of, you would say in English, in England, I think you'd say he was agin the government. Mm. He had a lot of energy. He was sort of cheeky. It would never occur to him to think of himself as a servant to anybody, and yet it was going to be his fate that he would be.
And you put him together with this man who had lived this life of privilege where much had been given to him. You've got two men who are really from opposite kinds of, with opposite sets of experiences, from opposite ends of the social scale. Parrot is older than Olivier. He's certainly seen a lot more of the world, and a lot of the dramatic tension here comes from these two guys butting heads because they don't really understand one another. They don't like one another, although that does change over the course of the story.
Yeah, they're really, I mean, one of the, when you talk about, you know, when one sits down to plan the book, you know, it is like a diagram, it's a sort of a plan, and I figure, well, in the end, they will end up with a sort of a friendship, and even when I decide that, I know it's sort of impossible, and I've got to make this impossible thing happen. And, then, you know, at the beginning, as you said, you know, they don't like each other. Parrot calls Olivier Lord Migraine and Lord Pintledy Pantledy and Lord Snobsduck, and Olivier, for his part, would simply have Parrot arrested on the boat coming out, and just he thinks he's the loathsome criminal sort of creature. So, and indeed he would, except that Parrot, a clever sort of a chap, and he's been a sort of a secretary, like a secretary, and he's been the one that's been given the job of preparing the financial documents for when they first arrive in America. And he's taken the precaution of making himself co-signatory. So just at the moment when they land in New York and Olivier's about to put Parrott in jail, he's faced with the rather uncomfortable fact that he's going to need him because if he's going to have any money at all. And so the friendship sort of begins through that sort of, you know, brutal necessity of money, and then progresses through a series of understandings and a kind act here, a rescue there. Parrott is sort of helpful in devising plans where Olivier can woo this young woman in Connecticut. And so finally a true affection develops, which I think Parrott says was the first friendship of its type ever in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. And yet it seems that that ultimately there's a kind of a gulf between the two men that simply can't be bridged, that goes back to both from where they have come and maybe also where they're going.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think, Olivier says, and I think I stole this from Tocqueville, that it's really, really the only people on Earth who he can really be relaxed and friendly with is another noble. And that although he may have a sort of a friend who's bourgeois, he will not ever really feel at ease with them. And so, if that's the case, the gulf between him and him imagining what it's like to be Parrott, you know, is a tough job for poor Olivier.
About midway through this part of Focus, Peter Carey is our guest. We're talking about his new novel. The title is Parrott and Olivier in America. It's published by Knopf, just out now in hardcover. He's the author of 11, including this. He's twice received the Booker Prize. Only one other person has received the Booker twice. And all of his previous books are all in paper, published by Vintage. So you can find them, I'm sure, in the library, in the bookstore. You want to read the new book, it's just out now, and it's quite good. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This kind of story is sort of an old story form. By that, I guess I mean the story about the person who goes on a journey to a place that is strange to them, and we sort of see it as they see it through their eyes, experience it as they have, and that the person in the process of trying to get to understand this new and strange place maybe comes to understand himself a little better. That's a pretty old, you know, general frame for a story, but one that's something about it is very pleasing and very satisfying, and that is what I wonder. What about that kind of story do you think is so satisfying?
Well, you know, the weird thing for me, I mean, there's a sort of an essential essential sort of stupidity that has to take hold in order for one to venture into one of these things. In other words, I'm not really thinking about a form. I'm not thinking about a way of storytelling. And I think if I did, you know, if I made the correct observation that you've just made, if I was able to make that when I was writing, I think I wouldn't be able to write it. Yeah, because for me, going in there, I want to make something that's never been made in the history of the world before, you know, and so I can't afford to think like that, and I can't afford to think, and the form of the that it takes is really dictated, you know, by the idea. And for me, I have a broad scheme and a map of where I want to go, but on the other hand, I saw a map recently which showed the banks of the Mississippi, you know, from a long time ago, and how they changed in varying, you know, flood after flood and after flood. And looking at this map with the changing course of something that began in one place and ended in another but had many changing things in between, I thought it's exactly like writing a novel. And so it's by way of saying your observation is obviously correct, but I can't think like that when I'm doing it.
I have in more than one article that I've read about you, and in even reviews of this book, reviewers have made the observation that they think that you like to write about displaced persons. Do you think that is true?
Yeah, well, whether I like to do it or not, I do it, and I can't help doing it. I mean, and sometimes for me, I mean, I think that question, you know, It's undeniably true. I continue to do it, and I continue to write about forgers and fakes and things like that.
Mm.
And sometimes, well, why do you do that? Well, it's sort of like, why do you walk the way you do? I suppose, in a way, you know, the history of my own small life contains a great deal of displacement. And so when I'm imagining things, then I inevitably go, when I invent displaced people. And this, you know, maybe more to do with, you know, the imagination being made by who you are. You know, there's a, it's not necessarily, or it's neither a strength nor a weakness, I suppose. It's just an expression of one's life that one doesn't even know that one's making.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate, and when writers say this, I don't know if people actually really understand it or buy it, but I guess I do appreciate the power of a character to create himself or herself. It makes me think of your book, My Life is a Fake, where in the course, what happens is that, roughly speaking, what happens is that a character in the book invents a character, and then one day that character comes knocking on their door. Which I think is a wonderful sort of idea that you play with in the book. And so I wouldn't expect any of your characters ever, you know, one day came knocking on your door. But that, as I say, I guess I do appreciate the fact that they do take on a life of their own.
Well, it's about what I was thinking of in that thing. It's about the power of the imagination. You know, that when you, I mean, the United States is an imaginative construct in a way. You know, you have to decide to. So, you know, you better be careful. I suppose the saying in that book, it's a little bit also of a Frankenstein story.
Mm-hmm.
You better be careful what you invent, because it might well happen.
Mm.
And there's a way sometimes when I walk along the street in here in New York City, and you can say, you can look at every single physical thing and think, well, this thing is an idea. Somebody thought this, and now there it is in bricks and mortar, or there it is the car going along the street. All these things are the imagination made concrete. I hope that makes sense, though.
I talked earlier about the fact that you were born in Australia and lived most of your life in Australia, but in the last 20 years you've been living in New York. Do you feel that you have come in some sense to feel that you are an American?
I think I'm absolutely the person with his heart in two places, I think. And you see, the minute you say, are you an American, you know, I pause. You know,
yeah.
I know I'm a New Yorker, and I feel myself to be at once a part of it and apart from the United States. I look at it, but I don't say they anymore. I sort of go, they, we. So on the one hand, I think I feel a great deal of comfort, and yet I am still an Australian, and so there's this thing where I am looking from the outside as well as knowing the inside. And that's a sort of for a writer, it's not a bad position, in the sense that for a human being, it might not be wonderful.
Hmm.
But for a writer, the thing of being familiar and yet the familiar to be strange, I hope, is a compensation for this sort of personal confusion, is that one has some insight.
You clearly did a lot of research about what life would have been like in the time that you're writing. For example, I know that you took some trouble to have some research done on a house that actually had been a house that Tocqueville had lived in, and you used that to create in the book the Olivier's house, the house where he grows up.
It was sort of insane what I did, really.
You think that was more than?
Well, it was sort of obsessive and excessive, but I do that. I do that out of a sort of an anxiety. But I found a French architectural historian who lived in Paris, and the Tocqueville Chateau is not so far from Paris. And I had him going there, and he was doing these beautiful not like architectural drawings, but sort of like with sort of colored blocks with labels that said this was here and that was there. And they were very beautiful to look at. So yeah, I'd get a PDF file on my computer and open it up and print it. And it was sort of they were all gorgeous looking things, and it helped me to understand the physical space that a young man, a young boy might have to move through. And in doing that and understanding the space, it's one of the things, like the issue of him being the child of survivors of the terror, that helps me form his character. But the minute I understood what the, can I say, you know, like the mechanism of the house was and how it worked and how it reflected society, I sort of threw it all away and built my own house. And I worry about the wonderful architectural historian has very little English, and I have no French. And I'm so worried that when the book comes out in France next year, he'll look at it and wonder what in the hell, why on earth I asked him to do any of this. But there was a very good reason, and I was learning a lot. But so with research, and you read and learn far, far, far more. You use about 1% or 2% of what you learn, and you have to learn that other 98% to feel confident and comfortable walking around in this world. You have to know the world. The book starts after the revolution, really, but you have to know the revolution and learn all those things, which, being an Australian, I'd never learned.
Well, that seems to me to be a real, if you're writing an historical novel, or at least if you're writing a novel that is not set in the present, that can be a difficult thing to do. That is, I think you can read a lot of historical novels that have far too much detail, way too much, and you know that the person obviously spent a lot of time to do that research, and they accumulated all this material, and apparently loved it so much, it was so excited about it, they could not throw any of it away, so it all ends up
so
in the book.
Kills, and it just chokes,
yes,
the book, right?
And it's just too much.
Yeah.
So there,
it's a hard thing to. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
Well, that's I just wonder, you know, how you draw that line between what is enough to give it the real feel, so that the reader will really feel that you're in another time, and how much is just too much.
Well, I think that the key to it all is the story, and you know, your characters, and your characters have to move and breathe and interact with each other, and that's what's important. And when I write, I want at every second, I want the world to be really fully, sensually, vividly alive. I want to know what things smell like. I want to know what the light is. I want to know. And if you've got done your research correctly, you'll have information enough to be able to get those smells and sounds and those things right. Mm-hmm. And they're the most important things. So to have your character alive in the second, in time and space, and history will supply the light and the smells and all of these sort of things. And so once you have that smell, it's going to tell you something about history, and the smell will be right because you'll have done your work. And of course, you have to worry about those big marks in history, you know, like if there's a revolution going on, how does that affect a printer in Paris who's living in a boarding house, you know, in the small way. And you have to get rid of things that the story has to rule, and that means you get rid of stuff. And so I have all the sympathy in the world for people who've let research clog up their narrative, only because at various stages in this book and the writing of this book, my research was clogging up my narrative, and I just had to get rid of more and more and more and more of it. Mm.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit more in this part of Focus. Peter Carey is our guest. We're talking about his new novel, Parrot and Olivier in America. It's just recently been published. It's now in hardcover by Knopf. And questions welcome. And we have somebody here who'd like to join in the conversation. They're in Urbana, where we are, and it's line one. Hello.
Good morning. Fascinating discussion. For the author, in your researches, which real American characters caught your attention, and why did they catch your attention?
You know, I wasn't really dealing with real American characters. I felt mostly free to invent people. I mean, basically what I do is I make up stuff. Uh-huh. And so the only real historical character that I was worried about was Alexis de Tocqueville. And even then, although I was interested in the, you know, that he was known, and I was interested in, for people who knew Tocqueville, they'll find things that reflect on Tocqueville. But even he, I made very clear to the reader that I was making his story up because he came with a guy called Beaumont, another aristocrat. Yes. And the pair of them traveled around America and they argued about democracy and they actually wrote three books together. Well, what I did to make it clear that I was making this up is I killed off my Beaumont guy before they left France. So, in other words, if you're looking for Tocqueville, clearly this is not Tocqueville.
I see.
Of course, when I get here, it's in the time of Andrew Jackson, and Andrew Jackson at the time is in a battle with the First Bank of the United States with Mr. Biddle. So I'm aware of that, but it's not going to be a central thing. It's just that I'll have had the way, you know, certain people talk about Jackson, and I'll have the way Olivier thinks that Jackson. He goes to Washington and finds the president sitting in a house all by himself, with not looking. It doesn't have all the sort of emblems of state and power and status and empire all around him. He's just a guy in a house, and for Olivier, an aristocrat, that's a terrifying and terrible thing to see. But I'm not really dealing with Andrew Jackson, but rather. There's Olivier responding to a certain American thing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu.
Can I say it's funny, too?
Yes. Oh, well yeah, and all
it's
of your...
It's so full of misunderstandings, of everybody misunderstanding everybody else, which seems to me the sort of... the basic fact of our existence.
It is a very funny book, no doubt, and that the misunderstandings and the fact that people just don't get each other and things that just happen. It really is a funny book, and they both really in their way, even though I think it's a little bit hard to like Olivier sometimes. Yeah. They're really both very charming characters, and I think in the course of the book, you want them both to have some satisfaction, some resolution, to find what it is they're looking for. You're rooting for both of them. I think you're even rooting for Olivier, even though sometimes you think that he's he is indeed Lord Migraine, and you'd like to clot him over the head with a 2x4. You want for them both to be well. So
even if Parrot wants to stuff his mouth with dirt.
Yeah, well, quite so. They're also two supporting characters, and I suppose one would be tempted to say that they're minor characters, except that they're really not. They're two women, and they're the women in these men's lives. One is an American woman that Olivier meets and falls in love with, and the other is a French woman that Parrot meets when he's in Paris. She's a painter, and she ends up coming to America with him. And I think that both these men, these women are very important to these men, maybe in slightly different ways. But I think for both of them, they're kind of a revelation.
Yeah, and I also think that you're quite right. I mean, they neither of them occupy a lot of pages in the book, but... I'd like to think that they had a sort of an intensity and a human importance in what's done, and that as for Mathilde, I have to tell you, I think she's hot.
this is the French painter. Yes, well,
yeah, she,
yes,
but I mean, she was somebody I really, really, really enjoyed writing. And she's somebody who, she's not a character you're really going to find in the history books. And yet, when you start to do a little nosing around and about, you know, the French women painters during this period, they were there. And some of them were extraordinary characters. Her character is totally created. But she's not the sort of person, I think, that you're used to thinking about in the past. A woman painter from that period. They were there, but we're not often made aware of them.
And she is certainly very passionate about her art. This is a passionate, sometimes kind of stormy relationship between her and Parrott. But it seems that she is extraordinarily important to him. And even though initially I'm not sure how he feels about her going along, that wasn't really part of the plan when things started out.
Well, she'd kicked him out the minute he said he was going. She threw all his clothes out. So he was absolutely distraught, and his life was sort of over. But, you know, there was. He was on the boat, and then he's on the boat, and she comes aboard, and he thinks that's fantastic. But then she won't speak to him. So, as you say, their relationship is tempestuous.
And the woman that Olivia ends up falling in love with, what strikes me about both of these women is they're both really, in their own way, very strong characters, and you would think they would be, if such a woman could have existed at that time, they would have been, both of them would have been exceptional.
Yes, and I believe women like that have existed in all times, but call me a romantic. Yeah.
We have another caller. Let's talk with them. Ann Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I haven't had a chance to listen to everything you've said, but something you said intrigued me, and I was waiting for a follow-up question, and maybe you said it and I didn't hear it. You said different people receive these characters differently, and it even seems to be by country. And so I was wondering, did you ask the question, which countries liked Olivier and which ones did not? Or which cultures, or what kind of countries prefer?
I think that basically one would say that the Australians and Americans have both, mostly they tend to love Parrott, and if you're looking for harsher things to be said about Olivier, that's where you will find them said, not by everybody, but somewhere, and where the English are more inclined to be tolerant and understanding of this aristocrat. So, you know, this is, I guess it's not such a mystery that this should happen. And it's by no means consistent. It's just one notices it, and it's just, and it's a sort of an illustration of the way, you know, when writers write, we can never really quite know and quite predict how people are going to feel about the characters we make. We think, there's no doubt, but then it isn't always exactly what one works out. And to go back to the novel, My Life is a Fake, which is narrated by a English woman who I really like. And she's sort of dry and sort of rather sarcastic, but I like her a great, great deal. A number of people absolutely loathed her, and I was very shocked. So
right.
One can't always control this.
Right,
nor should one.
On the radio.
All right, well, thank you. It seems to me interesting that the English would respond to Olivier, given that they have this sort of troubled relationship with the French.
Well, I think it's more to do with class.
Ah.
And the notion of the master and the servant, and yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go say Jeeves and Worcester, but I mean, that's a sort of a crude illustration of something that's very popular, in which the role of the upper class twit is, you know, that he's accepted, he's part of society, and that's sort of a type that is known and so on. So I'm not for a second comparing my book with Worcester and Jeeves, but there is that master servant thing, and there is maybe some more intrinsic sort of sympathy for the aristocratic figure.
Something else here, we have a couple of minutes, and I would like to have you talk about another. You deal with a lot of ideas and a lot of interesting questions in this book. One being about whether or not a culture like the United States can produce can be a producer of art? That, you know, can art, can American culture produce culture, quote unquote?
Well, that's the sort of aristocratic line that, you know, that and indeed it was a Tocqueville line that, you know, his severe doubt whether great art could be produced in a democracy, and his. And yeah, clearly this is wrong. I mean, the book itself, I hope, is a refutation of that. And this work made in New York, it says. But I think that what he's really worried about, Tocqueville was worried about, and we could say Olivier was worried about, is the effect of in a market-driven economy. And then if you have, say, the market for art driven by people with a lot of money and a desire to establish their status who have not taken the time to learn and to educate themselves, then you will sort of have the sort of figure of hedge fund managers wrestling in the mud over who's going to pay the most for Jeff Koons. You know, so I think there's really something to be said for this. Of course, great art has been produced in this particular democracy, the United States. So to say it can't be is obviously not true. And there have been huge numbers of very well-educated collectors and patrons of art. So we know it's not exclusively true. But we also know I was shocked the other week to talk to or hear a publisher talk about, not one of my publishers, I hasten to add, talk about this category in publishing which they referred to as faux literature or false literature, not really literature, which work that would be sold as literature and people would buy it thinking it was literature, but that clearly wasn't. And that would be exactly the sort of degeneration of taste and knowledge that the aristocrat would worry about.
Well, this in here, I suppose that's where we end up with the two men and the one being the pessimist who fears for the future of American and of the American people and of American culture. And you've almost quoted some of the words that you give to Parrott, Olivier. And then Parrott says, well, you know, he says, there is no tyranny in America, nor ever could be. Your horrid visions concerning fur traders are groundless. The great ignoramus will not be elected. The illiterate will never rule. Your bleak certainty that there can be no art in a democracy is unsupported by the truth. That's after Olivier says, I'll tell you what America will become. The public squares will be occupied by an uneducated class who will not be able to quote a line of Shakespeare. Well, there we are. I mean, yes.
And maybe we should just sit down and flip on our televisions and have a look what we're doing.
So the
argument continues. I think.
Can you hold both of these men and both of these assessments in your head at the same time?
Yeah. Well, I think it's how we. This is the world we're living in right now. And there is no question, I think, that we are, generally speaking, swimming in a sea of cultural garbage. And that, at the same time, great works of art are being produced.
Yeah. Well, there we'll leave it with my recommendation. People should read Parrott and Olivier in America by our guest Peter Carey, just out now, published by Knopf. He's the author of 11 novels altogether, and the others are available in paper published by Vintage. Mr. Carey, thank you very much for talking
with us. Well, thank you so much. It was fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
Sunshine marks our Monday, mostly sunny and a high of 90 today. South winds 10 to 15 miles an hour, gusts to around 20. For tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 68. South winds at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow will be partly sunny, with Tuesday's high 91 again. South winds at 10 to 15. For tomorrow night, mostly cloudy and a low of 72. Light south winds, partly sunny and 88 for Wednesday. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
Humankind.